All right, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. I'm going to talk about kinematic space today, and which is the program we have been developing over the past year and a half with my collaborators Bartek Cech, Sam McAnliss, and Jamie Sally, and with the help of other people as well, Ben Mosk, for example. And although you may have heard about kinematic space in the context of tensor networks, this is not going to be the focusing of today's talks, both mine and Sam's. So let me, first of all, interrupting for questions about anything. And let me just take a few minutes to motivate our approach and why we do what we do. So we're trying to understand the holography microscopically. And we want to understand how the CFT encodes the basic semi-classical structures in the bulk, how we can read off the bulk geometry, its dynamics, and the low energy effective degrees of freedom. And starting with geometry, Ryu Nakaganagi gave us a clue that entanglement entropy of subregions in the CFT are encoded in areas of minimal surfaces in the bulk, or in the particular context that I will be focusing on, and not some, in ADS3, it's geodesic lengths. And what we are interested in is actually constructing a framework, a language, in order to extract this data from the entanglement pattern of the state. So our proposal was that such a natural language is given to us by integral geometry, since it's the field that studies geometric properties of manifolds, by using special classes of extended objects and global properties of them, like, for example, geodesics. The space of geodesics, the space of oriented geodesics, I would call kinematic space. And in holography, it becomes particularly interesting exactly because it has this dual nature. It can be defined both in the bulk as the space of geodesics that span the manifold and are boundary anchored in the case of ADS, and as well as on the CFT independently as an information theoretic space that organizes the entanglement pattern of CFT subregions in a geometric way. Now, what I will argue, this was initially a construct that helped us understand geometry from information theory in a unified way, but we're going to take these ideas and apply them more broadly in an effort to understand holography in general. So I will tell you various aspects of holography that the kinematic framework ties together in a nice way. I already talked about kinematic space being related to bulk reconstruction, as well as information theory and tensor networks, which I'm briefly going to mention, but not focus on. And I'm going to focus on the new stuff, which is how the OPE, the basic structures in the CFT, the basic kinematical structures, like the OPE and conformal blocks, are encoded in the kinematic formalism, how we can derive from that the recent story of geodesic Witten diagrams, and approach again from a different perspective the story of bulk local operators. There's going to be a hint of a quantum field theoretic description of CFT in elliptic de Sitter space, and we may be able and we will also be able to use this formula to approach the linearized Einstein equations that a lot of people have worked on, too many to mention in the introduction. So this is what I will try to communicate by the end of this talk, and actually by the end of our talks, me and Sam's. And here's a brief outline. I will start with a brief review, reviewing the basic structures and the basic ideas of kinematic space, both in integral geometry and in information theory. And then I'm going to focus on new developments by basically trying to show all these other connections that I promised you by introducing this new concept of kinematic operators, which is a new organization of the operator content of the CFT in the language of kinematic space, and derive its holographic duals, and then we're going to apply it to the various aspects that I told you before. And hopefully I will have time to make a brief mention about two notions of locality that naturally emerge from this formalism. So without delaying any further, let's start with what is kinematic space? Well, we define kinematic space as a space of oriented geodesics. And as a matter of fact, let's restrict right now on a global time slice of ADS, which is just a hyperbolic disk. So a natural way here, you see a geodesic on a hyperbolic disk, and each geodesic becomes a point on this new manifold that I'll call kinematic space. A natural way of parameterizing it is with respect to the two endpoints of the geodesic, the location of the two endpoints. For the particular case of ADS3, which is going to be our toy example, there's another nice organization in terms of the location of the center point and its size. And the only information that I allow myself access to is the length of all geodesics, of all boundary angle geodesics that lie on this slice. This defines a function on my kinematic space.
Sorry, the geodesics always in a like a Euclidean space?
I have chosen a global timeless already, yes. So yes. I will talk about how to generalize in a more covariant object, but let's focus on that now. This is the basic formalism that we have already introduced.
Is kinematic space a supercomputable?
Yes, I'm going to talk about it right now. So kinematic space cylindrical geometry has structure. Yeah, has structure, and in particular it has a symplectic form. I will call it volume form because it will help us later on. In the classic examples, when we deal with symmetric manifolds, this volume form is usually derived by symmetry, and Sam is going to mention more about this more formal approach. But in the particular case of two-dimensional manifolds, which are timeless of three-dimensional ADS, asymptotically ADS spacetimes, we were able to generalize this and write it in terms of a second derivative of the length of the geodesics with respect to the two endpoints.
Excuse me.
Yes.
The length is always infinite, so you're
doing we regulate it, but this is invariant under the it doesn't depend on the regulator. The second derivative of the entanglement entropy for the length of geodesics and asymptotically ADS, it's invariant under it's UV independent.
Half divergence, which cancels out under the derivative.
Yeah, this S over here is a logarithm of the spatial size over the regulator, and the two derivatives cancel the regulator, even if it's not spatially homogeneous. So, but this is not the only structure that it has. It's also a partially ordered set, and you can see the different types of order. These are two geodesics, and they have some boundary support, and their boundary support may one geodesic may contain the other or may not, and there is also a borderline case where the two geodesics share an endpoint. This I'm going to geometrize it by introducing a notion of causal structure. This may look a little bit ad hoc, but we'll see that it's in fact a necessary ingredient of kinematic space when we approach it more formally later on. But these are the two types of geodesics. I will call the two geodesics that contain each other time-like separated, space-like, and light-like. And I will have a two-dimensional manifold, kinematic space, with a volume form and a causal structure. I can define a metric on it. And this metric is given by this simple form. And notice that the endpoints of the geodesics serve as my null coordinates. If I apply this logic to just two-dimensional Lissiter space, the metric on kinematic space, two-dimensional and Lissiter space, the metric on kinematic space becomes two-dimensional hyperbolic plane, the metric on kinematic space becomes two-dimensional Lissiter space, with the size of the geodesic being the auxiliary time-like coordinate. And just a brief note, which is going to be relevant for later, at the asymptotic boundary of this Lissiter, when L goes to zero, it's actually the physical manifold on which the CFD is actually defined. And you can understand this as by considering a geodesic that shrinks all the way down to a point. As I shrink its size, it shrinks down to a point on the actual boundary.
Can you say again in what sense this metric is compatible with this symplectic structure?
Well, it has its volume form. The volume form of this metric is precisely the volume form I showed you before.
It's two-dimensional.
Yeah, it's a.
Usually we don't put a metric on phase space.
That's right, yeah. Well, there is a question of how relevant, how useful this metric is. For the particular case of the hyperbolic plane, this metric is actually of use. In particular, points now become space-like geodesics in this manifold. For more general cases, it's still under consideration whether this makes sense. It's a good question. But if I give you a symplectic structure and a causal structure, you can definitely, a two-dimensional manifold, you can definitely define a metric. There's a question of how useful it can be.
Can you flip back to the definition of the form of this stuff?
Yeah.
Just to compare it to the metric?
Yeah. So x, this to be explicit, x left and x right are my two null coordinates. So this, this is the volume form in a Lorentzian volume. So you should imagine a causal diamond. A causal diamond, I don't know if you can see that, but you should imagine a little causal diamond here, and the volume of this diamond is given by this volume.
So related to Adam's question, if you have a metric and a symplectic form, then together they define a complex structure.
Yes.
Is that relevant here?
So I'm not going to use this complex structure. I define this metric. There's another way for the case of the hyperbolic plane. There's another way of defining the metric as the only metric compatible with the isometries of the manifold. But I just wanted to say that given that we have a generalization of this volume form and the causal structure, we can build the metric in more general grounds. So here's the metric. And what do we learn from it? What we learn from it is we can actually use these ideas to reconstruct the bulk geometry. And this is done from boundary data and in a diffeomorphism invariant way. And the way to do it is by using the Crofton formula, which vaguely tells you, well, precisely, but without, I'm not showing you the details, that lengths of curves in the bulk can be translated to volumes in the geodetic space, where this omega is exactly the measure I defined before, this volume form. Yes?
So can you go back one slide?
Yes.
Can you talk about the boundary, the endpoints of a geodesic, and you talk about that it's a unique geodesic, but in general, given two boundary points, we have multiple lengths. So how would you define a length of a geodesic given just two endpoints?
Good. So when you have multiple geodesics connecting for two specific boundary endpoints, one needs to extend the space, and you need an extra characterization. A better characterization in this case, for example, is by choosing one endpoint and the angle, for example, with respect to the boundary. Now, for the specific types of manifolds that we will be talking about, this can be easily dealt with. Of course, there are other manifolds. This is not supposed to give you the answer to everything. This is supposed to approach certain questions and make certain connections that we're interested in.
And sorry, as long as we're back on that previous slide.
Yes.
You mentioned that the space-like boundary is the physical boundary of the ball.
Yes.
So kinematically, that's clear. Is it trivial that the, I guess if a space-like boundary of the Sitter space, of course, has a conformal metric on it, but not a metric. So when you say it's the physical boundary, you mean as a set of points, but not as a metric?
Yeah, yes, as a set of points.
Or is it more generally true after conformal transformations?
So, well, the purpose of my statement was that the set of points that lie at the boundary of the space are precisely the physical points on the CFT.
And I guess the conformal structure is the same. That's also trivial. It's just this measure factor.
Precisely, exactly.
Okay.
So, and here's a picture of it. You can define a curve, and then you can find an appropriate volume. I'm not explaining the details here, but you're going to define an appropriate volume on the space of geodesic, which is defined as what? It's basically the set of geodesics that intersect that curve. By counting how many geodesics intersect the curve, measured by an appropriate measure, I can actually describe the length of this curve. Now, validity, since there were a lot of questions about this subject, of course, the formulas I've presented so far, I'm talking about global slices of three-dimensional spaces, I'm talking about static cases, and I must not have any conjugate points, and my tangent space in the manifold needs to be spanned by boundary anchored geodesics. Not all of them are necessary. One second. Not all of them are necessary. The 2+1 dimensional restriction, as well, is definitely can definitely be lifted, as Sam will talk about it. There are ideas of moving it beyond the static case, which we're not going to discuss today.
Separately.
The conjugate points are points that are connected by an infinite number of geodesics.
So just a reminder, so what is the data that specifies the endpoints A and B in the kinematic space?
Oh, right. So, good. So this is a detail that I'm not going to talk about because I don't want to go into so much detail. That's a good question. Having just the volume form is not enough to reconstruct the bulk geometry. We need an extra assumption. And that assumption is that our manifold is in fact Riemannian. If I give you what I've given you is that lengths are volumes in kinematic space. So I've given you a definition of distance, but this is in general a Finsler distance, not always a Riemannian. So by demanding that our manifold is Riemannian, we can identify a set of curves which will correspond to the points in the bulk. It's a little bit more involved, that's why I'm not going to go into details today, but by demanding, basically I need to identify the sets of geodesics that intersect at the points in the bulk. And this can be identified in a systematic way by demanding that my manifold is Riemannian. But this is not the purpose of this talk, so I'm going to move a little bit faster. I promised you a connection to information theory. And well, on the boundary now, from the boundary perspective, kinematic space becomes a space of intervals, organized in a particular way. And in view of the Ryota-Kaninagi relation, the kinematic volume is now given by an information theoretic quantity, conditional mutual information. This is just re-expressing the second derivative of entropy. And you see that the positivity of the measure, for example, is provided by the strong subadditivity of entanglement entropy. And what do we learn from it? Well, first of all, kinematic space as an information theoretic space now, it maps out in a particular way the entanglement pattern of the state, and it provides information geometry for it. You can see, for example, that various if I consider three adjacent intervals, the various information theoretic quantities localize in volumes. Like for example, the mutual information, the conditional mutual information of A and C given B, or the mutual information of A and B, they localize in particular volumes, which gives us an extra handle because now we can use the Crofton formula and express given information theoretic interpretation for the length of any curve. And as many of you may have heard, this kinematic organization, we argue that is actually a type of organization of the entanglement that can be achieved, can be realized through a tensor network representation of the state. But not, in particular case, for the ground state, the usual mera achieves such an organization of the entanglement. For more general cases, of course, the simple mera does not do the job, but kinematic space is extendable, at least to some classes of geometries, and that gives us a prescription of how to go about it and how to build different types of tensor networks that organize entanglement in the kinematic way. And just as a disclaimer, this is not a statement that one cannot put a tensor network in the actual physical manifold of the bulk. This is our tensor networks appear as a natural way of organizing the entanglement in the way implied by kinematic space. We have this structure, and we try to realize it. So I don't want to put it on kinematic versus real. So this is all I'm going to say about tensor networks. And I'm going to make one step and generalize kinematic space in a more covariant way, in a more covariant construct. And then I'm going to jump to the actual new developments, which are more related to fields and the holographic dictionary rather than networks. Let me actually hear questions.
You're always talking about tensor networks.
Yes.
When you say it's a central realization of it, is it a useful realization? Does one learn anything by saying that there is a tensor network realization of kinematic space geometry?
Good. So first of all, the one thing that the one thing that we wanted to learn is whether you see this little map of information that kinematic space suggests. What we wanted to learn is whether this is actually just an auxiliary way of organizing things, or whether it's actually an organization that can be achieved in a specific representation of the state. And tensor network representations of states seem to be useful for that. Now, the power of kinematic space really comes from the fact that
was a way to sort of compute IA, CB in this way.
Exactly. Okay. And it serves, and now there's two things that one can learn. On one hand side, the power of kinematic space in holography comes from the fact that I can actually reconstruct the bulk geometry using its structure. The power of kinematic space in information theory comes from the fact that I have a quantitative way, or at least quantitative conditions, in order to build a network representation of different states other than the vacuum. In particular, if you believe these answers that tensor network, if you try to, and take the kinematic organization of entanglement and say I want to realize it in a tensor network representation, that gives you certain a recipe for building that network. It's not always possible to build it, and that's going to be the subject of a future publication. Which is
can you remind us what that figure means?
Which figure? This one?
Yeah, what's it?
Good. So this is the space of intervals. I organize them by their location and their size, and this is basically kinematic space. A kinematic space has a...
Sorry, just to clarify, when the A and B intersect?
A and B, you mean the intervals?
Yeah.
No, these are just adjacent. See, it's the next to each other. The set and endpoint.
Oh, okay.
It's A, B, and C.
I don't know how literally to take that picture. So those are three intervals that meet at, to the endpoint.
That's right. It's literal. Yeah, it's as literal as can be. Yeah.
The bottom of the graph is intervals that are points. So it's isomorphic to the space you start.
When you go to zero size intervals, you actually have the physical points of your manifold. So these are physical intervals in the bulk, on the boundary, I'm sorry. And this figure basically says the following, that I told you that this kinematic space has a volume form defined on it, and this volume form is given by conditional mutual information. So all I'm doing is just saying that if I take a little bit of a little Lorentzian volume, a little causal diamond, its volume, its Lorentzian volume, is actually given by this quantity, which measures the conditional mutual information of A and C given B. Now, if I take this volume form and I integrate it over extended regions, for example, if I integrate it over this region, what I calculate is the mutual information of A and B. So what I'm showing here is that volumes in this construct of kinematic space are associated to specific mutual information quantities, specific information quantities of the intervals in the CFM.
And likewise, if you had more intervals and a higher tau.
Yeah, yeah. We don't deal with with intervals that don't share an endpoint. One has to be careful that we can't really talk about... So it's an organization of the single interval entanglement pattern, as I state up there.
That mutual information is divergent, then, because they share
that mutual information...
The fact that it's going right down to UV means there's a divergence.
Yes. Yes, and you can see that divergence because the relevant causal diamond goes all the way to the asymptotic boundary of the sitters.
Good. Any other questions? Good. So I'm going to now generalize kinematic space to a more covariant version of it, which is basically just include all space like geodesics, all space like geodesics of the bulk manifold. And now this is a four-dimensional space. I have two endpoints for each geodesic. I'll call left and right the two endpoints. I have two coordinates to describe each, so this is a four-dimensional manifold. And now it's more appropriately it's more appropriate to say that the boundary version of the description of kinematic space on the boundary is not the space of intervals, but rather the space of causal diamonds. The reason for that is because I can actually use the conformal group and deform an interval and move it around this causal diamond. Given two endpoints, I can pick an interval, but there are conformal transformations that move it around. So a more appropriate object now is the actual causal diamond. And I will use a convenient parameterization, just setting some notation. Z and Z bar are not complex coordinates. They're null coordinates, left moving and right moving, respectively. Don't ask me why I'm using that notation. So let's see what this object generally looks like. Well, Kozalev now is a little bit more complicated, because now we're dealing with causal diamonds, and I have a more complicated the containment relation. I have more options for it. Two causal diamonds may contain each other, or may overlap, or partially overlap. So I need actually two auxiliary times to describe this containment relation. And its metric, for the case of ADS, can be derived formally, and Sam will do it for us. I'm going to motivate for you because I don't want to focus on that. It's determined by SO2,2 invariance, the actual conformal invariance, and the need to reproduce the appropriate measure on the appropriate 2D slice that we previously discussed. You may not be surprised if I tell you that the metric is actually a simple generalization of the previous one that I showed you, at least for the simple cases that we understand.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the formula. You say that we have a four-dimensional space that looks like a metric on a two-dimensional space.
Where no, over here I have two endpoints, and each left and right, and each endpoint has two coordinates. So I actually have four terms here.
Oh, I see. So X, U, L corresponds to what, the Z, L, and ZL bar that you had before?
Exactly, yeah. You can take a derivative with respect to any coordinates that you like, but okay. The most natural coordinates will be the Z coordinates. And let me actually jump straight to the ADS3 case, because this is really what we understand. For the case of ADS3, mm-hmm. the metric becomes a product of two decider spaces. One decider space is constructed by left-moving null coordinates. One decider space is constructed by right-moving null coordinates. For example, if you take this causal diamond, this is my left endpoint, this is my right endpoint. This is the L is the left-moving separation, L bar is the right-moving separation, and the corresponding null center points. Now, this is just in order to show you this metric. The geometric potential of this object is currently under investigation. We do understand some stuff of it about it. For example, if you consider different 2D slices on it, one can reconstruct lengths of curves that space-like curves that do not fall on a specific slice. This is still under construction. The reason why I'm showing you this metric is because it's going to be relevant to the next part, which I'm going to jump right after this slide.
A quick question on this is, if you tried to do this in a more general manifold, then you wouldn't have this nice relationship between geodesics and causal diamonds. That seems more natural to what, like causal holographic information and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't want to necessarily make a statement of that type. I will not claim that we understand what this object would look like, what the boundary version of kinematic space for excited states would look like. I see the causal diamonds as the natural thing associated to a pair of points, and I don't necessarily relate it to a causal or entanglement wedge in the bulk. So, yeah.
By more general geometry, you meant something in higher dimensions?
No, staying in three dimensions, but I mean, for example, if you have a star in the middle.
Boundary. I mean, locally, everything is going to factorize into left movers and right movers, regardless of their geometry. Though there may be some interesting global issues.
Yeah.
And like that's flat, the flat space version. So if you took it to be a cylinder, for example, then they don't completely. There's some sort of interesting modding out, so it's not a tensor problem.
Precisely, yeah. There is actually a symmetry of kinematic space because of the fact that I can see in geodesic as either subtending this interval or its complement. So it's a more complicated structure, indeed.
Was there a question?
Oh, I don't know. I thought you had a question. Okay, so that is the end of the slides, and now I'm going to go to a different subject of actually taking these ideas, which taking the essence of these ideas and applied in organizing the field theory both in the CFT and in the bulk. So if you have any questions about geometry and information theory, now is the time. How do I leave this thing? Wait, okay?
Yeah, the middle one.
Thanks. Okay, so here's what I'm going to talk about now. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the question, can we actually use these ideas of kinematic space in order to learn something about the holographic dictionary, about how the effective bulk degrees of freedom emerge from the CFT degrees of freedom? And I'm going to do that by constructing what I will call kinematic operators. By the end of this part of the talk, I will hopefully be able to communicate the various connections that I promised you before, the connections between kinematic space and the modular Hamiltonian, the OPE and conformal blocks, and the story of entanglement holography of Myers and collaborators, as well as the recent story of geodesic Witten diagrams. I will construct this object, derive the holographic dual, and prove these things if time allows. So let's start from the basics. So we have a CFT2, and we know what the operator content of that theory in principle is. I have the identity, I have a bunch of quasi-primaries, which are organized in irreducible representations of the conformal group, of the global conformal group, and I may have various number of left-moving and right-moving periodics. This form the descendants. Now we understand the operator content in this local basis. What I want to define is a new basis, a basis that will be appropriate for talking about kinematic space. Kinematic space, I told you, is the space of causal diamonds. And once more, I have two endpoints, left and right. I will call 1 and 2 from now on. Z1, Z1 bar, Z2, Z2 bar. And I will define again L, L bar, as well as a center point, which I'll call X and X bar. This is just setting the coordinates. What I want to do is I want to define fields on kinematic space. Let's say a scalar field. What would a scalar field be? Well, scalar fields are just operator-valued functions. Operators that have a functional dependence on the coordinates of my space. In this case, my space is the space of causal diamonds. Therefore, I will define an operator, a CFT operator phi, which will have a functional dependence on Z1, Z2, Z1 bar, Z2 bar. And the purpose, my goal now, is to actually determine this operator, to rewrite it, to re-express it in terms of the usual local operators that I know. So I will remember what we do in standard QFT. One defines scalar fields as forming irreducible representations of your isometry group. You define an operator as, for example, a scalar operator has the property that phi at some transform point x prime is equal to phi of x, and that, for example, if C is a conformal Casimir of your group, then as an operator, this needs to be an eigenvector. This is just the way we define it. If I take the Casimir and commute it with the operator, this needs to be an eigenoperator. So this is going to be the principle that I'm going to use. I know that this is a function of kinematic space coordinates, and I know that I have a symmetry on my boundary, conformal symmetry. Therefore, if I consider the commutator of C with respect to phi, I should demand that this is an eigenvector. That will help me derive a differential equation for this field phi, which will serve as my equation of motion. First of all, what we learn, I said that phi needs to form an irreducible representation of the conformal group. Therefore, I'm going to have a phi for every global family, h, h bar. Furthermore, since this is an operator in a specific representation, it should be written as an appropriate sum of the operator h, h bar, and its descendants, a sum over k and k bar, with appropriate coefficients here, which have a functional dependence on the z's and the z bars. Another way of writing the same thing is by saying there's a function c of the coordinates and the derivatives acting on O. And my point is to actually derive this function.
So what order in 1 over n are you trying to do?
Good. So I'm taking a free limit, which is the n goes to infinity limit. Uh-huh. I'm going to make comments, if I have time, about 1 over n later. But right now, what I'm doing is group theory. Therefore, I'm manifestly at the n equals infinity limit. I'm just reorganizing the CFT operator structure using conformal invariants. But now, the non-trivial thing is that I'm doing representation theory on intervals, and that will help me actually get a lot of mileage with connecting with the other things that I'm going to try to connect. So it's n goes to infinity.
Can you say where exactly you made that assumption here?
You will see it in a second.
Right now you haven't, right?
He hasn't yet, is what I thought.
No, well, right now I'm doing group theory. Group theory, you can do group theory without any lattice.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
When I say that I will interpret the differential operator that I'm going to derive from this condition as an equation of motion, it's then that I make the assumption of n equals infinity. I'll make it clear in a second. So these are the two things that I need to define. I know what the Casimir is, but one has to be careful because we actually want the two-point Casimir in that case. Because we're doing representation theory on intervals, on bilocals. So by demanding this condition, I get a differential operator that I will... first I forgot to say something. My Casimir, the isometry group, is SO2,2. And we know that this factorizes to two SO2,1 components, one for the left movers and one for the right movers. And therefore, I have two Casimirs, a C left and a C right, which commute. And as a result of that, this function actually decomposes to a function depending only on the left moving coordinates and another function depending only on the right moving coordinates. And I will determine these functions from this condition. One can do the algebra. One can take this operator equation and re-express it as a differential operator acting on the function phi equal lambda phi. This is just choosing the appropriate representation, doing the appropriate commutators. And what this becomes is the following. So we see that if I assign what I would call a local operator on the space of intervals or causal diamonds, and I group them into irreducible representations of the conformal group, what I get back is a Klein-Gordon equation on this kinematic geometry I was mentioning before. This is the presentation theory, but the non-trivial statement is that if I go to the space of intervals, conformal invariance actually naturally gives it a specific metric structure. Now, this is an equation derived from group theory. If I want to actually interpret it as an equation of motion, well, I can't do that if I don't have a large n expansion, because this implies free propagation, and we know which would imply that an endpoint function of phi is trivially expressed in terms of the two-point functions, which we will see this is not true. This is a CFT operator. We have OP coefficients that are non-trivial. So it's only at large n that this can be interpreted as an actual equation of motion in kinematic space. So I showed you that by doing representation theory on causal diamonds, we naturally get the Klein-Gordon equation in kinematic space. Let's solve it. To solve it, we need boundary conditions. The boundary conditions I have two de Sitters. The two boundaries that are at L goes to 0 and as bar goes to 0. So the boundary conditions I will select are the following. As L goes to 0, I want all the left moving descendants to disappear, to drop out. Therefore, C will go to L to the h. The reason for the existence of this L to the h, and the reason why I have this L to the h here, is because I'm trying to find a scalar field. So if I have, even for the primary, I will need an L to the h in order to actually make it conformally invariant. Same thing for the right moving separation. As the right moving separation goes to 0, I want the C bar function to go to L bar to the h bar. The reason for this is the following. As I take both L and L bar go to 0, I'm shrinking my causal diamond down to a point on the boundary. So what I would like, a physical choice for my boundary conditions, is to say that my kinematic field actually becomes the local quasi-primary at that point, as I take this limit. It's my choice, but it's a natural choice. Given this equation, and this boundary condition, I can actually solve it.
And the solution is unique?
And the solution is unique, yeah. You will see that the solution actually is a solution that you already know. I just took a very weird route to explaining it. So,
why is the solution unique given that boundary condition?
Well, this is a standard Cauchy problem.
Well, you mean unique as an operator. You mean there will in fact be arbitrary operator value coefficients that appear.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, that's what I mean by that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But those are just the coefficients that appear in the local operators.
That's right, yeah.
I see, okay.
So one can solve it. It's a series over descendants, and one can derive the precise coefficients. The interesting thing is that you can actually resum this series of descendants. And you can resum this series of descendants and give it an integral representation, which is going to be what I will be interested in. So this phi for the family H and H bar can actually be represented, keep in mind we're in a Lorentzian CFT, can actually be represented as a smeared operator over the entire causal diamond associated to these two points. And the smearing function is precisely this. The same thing for the bar coordinates. And forgive my handwriting, I have to do it kind of quickly. What I do is I take the actual primary defined at the points Z and Z bar, and I smear it over the causal diamond of spanned by 1 and 2 with this kernel. Good. This is a solution to my kinematic field. You have seen this before in two different places. One place is a modular Hamiltonian. You can do this for any quasi-primary. So I can do this for the stress tensor. I have two different components, the left moving and the right moving. If I do it for T, I will derive a phi for T. This is in fact, since this is a function of volume Z, I can just explicitly perform the bar integral, and this comes with a normalization factor that I completely ignored. And this becomes an integral over of Z2 minus Z1 and C minus Z1 over Z12 times T. If I do this for the T bar coordinate, for the T bar component, I find phi of T bar, the corresponding quantity, and it's not hard to convince yourselves that by adding them, what you get is a modular Hamiltonian. So the modular Hamiltonian is a kinematic operator. And that was already anticipated, in a sense, because Rob Myers, Michael Heller, Neyman, and Jan de Boer had a paper earlier this fall actually saying that this modular Hamiltonian indeed satisfies an equation of motion in the sitter. Now we see it emerging from a more principled approach, but it's essentially the same statement. Another thing about this quantity is the following. I need to erase something. Another thing about it is that it actually appears in the most natural structure of the CFT, which is the operator product expansion. Consider two primaries, and I'll take them to have the same weight. From now on, I'm suppressing the bar coordinates, O delta and O delta Z2. This operator product, I can actually expand it to a sum over all operators on my theory. I will be consistent and just completely forget about the left movers. And I have a sum over all families plus a sum over all descendants, appropriately weighted with certain coefficients over here. we want to. This is the usual OPE. But these are the only parameters that are really interested for the dynamics. These coefficients over here are completely fixed by conformal invariants. And as a matter of fact, this object as a whole can be proved to be precisely what I previously called kinematic operators. Therefore, in terms of these objects, the OP of two local operators can be actually just expanded modulo of this prefactor, can be actually expanded as a sum over kinematic operators, which is that we just absorbed all the redundant kinematics in the definition. But now this definition has a geometric meaning, can actually, at least at large order, at large n, can actually be understood as a field propagating in this geometry. So it's a geometric way of re-expressing this OPE that we'll see have some, that we will see has some interesting implications.
And just to make sure I'm following, this is now the OPE in Lorentzian signature.
That's right, yeah. But I'm taking the two points to be spatially separated, so I don't have any trouble with the analytic continuations or.
Oh, you're strict to that context.
Yeah, yeah. Because I define. Yeah, I define my space of interval as being spatially separated. Yeah. So this is really a space like OPE I'm doing here. Mm-hmm. So it's a well defined thing. So you can see now something that's interesting, and there's actually a cute exercise you can do.
Can you explain what the coefficient C delta delta A?
Well, this is the OPE coefficient. Yeah. I have a sum over all families, and they come with a specific weight. These are not predetermined by conformal invariants. These are actually parameters of my theory. So I'm not going to say anything about them. These are the coupling constants you can think of.
Your intervals have to be space-like separated.
Yes. This is the definition of kinematic space. So yes, by construction, I mean space-like separations. So, good. So now you can see a connection that these phis have this nice integral representation, which make connection to the modular Hamiltonian, and they connect to the OPE. So a nice exercise one can do is the following. As a result of that, the modular Hamiltonian is nothing but the strength tensor block contribution to the OPE. And one can actually start, for example, from a correlation function of twist operators, perturb the state by a little bit, controlled by a parameter epsilon, and one can actually show that one can actually derive from CFT principles the first law of entanglement entropy, almost trivially, by just proving, just convincing themselves that it's only the stress tensor block that contributes at leading order in epsilon. So the first law just becomes a statement about the stress tensor block being the only one relevant in the correlation function of twist operators.
Are we going to see some condition on the CFT that has to be satisfied for the, that to be interpreted as a gravitational
system? I haven't talked about gravitational dual so far. This is a CFT result. The only part where interpretation issues come in is...
You talked about the entanglement person. Well, okay.
So, yeah, there is a condition in interpreting this equation that I wrote down as an actual equation of motion in what I call kinematic space. The condition on that is one necessary condition at this level is infinite n. The reason for that is the following. I derived this... I actually constructed these objects. You can see that this depends on the primary operator. So from CFT, from the CFT, if I take, for example, a three-point function of these operators phi, this is going to be non-trivial. It will depend on the operator constant. You'll have a non-trivial result. If I take this interpretation seriously, this tells me that I actually have these objects freely propagating this geometry. So their three-point function is trivial. The consistency between them is achieved if I actually assume that my CFT has a large n expansion, in which case we have a factorization of higher point correlation functions in terms of the two-point correlation functions. So that's a necessary assumption. There is a question of what do you need to do in order to preserve that interpretation at higher orders in n. I'm not going to address that because it's still still in progress.
But I'm confused about where you've used that interpretation. I mean, did you need that
from
a block story?
Oh, no, this is a CFT result. This is basically a reorganization of CFT, but I also derived it in order to, I also made the claim that I can interpret this as an equation of motion in my auxiliary geometry. That was the only place where I needed
it. I'm confused just by the fact that when you say an equation of motion, I mean, you wrote down this formula over here for phi hh, which I take it is true whether or not you would claim this is an equation of motion, that is, that phi hh is just going to be the definition, that thing that's in the box is the definition, even if you're not in a large in theory. Uh-huh. But then I'm confused. You seem to say that, well, okay, I mean, I guess it seems clear that if you're not at large n, then that thing is not going to have trivial three-point functions.
Yes. This is an object one can construct. One can relate to the OPE and the modular Hamiltonian in any CFT because it's built by conformal theory, by representation theory. But the only statement I'm making is that, because I'm going to make connection later on, that the equation that this thing satisfies, and this is built out of, looks like a Klein-Gordon equation on my kinematic space, which is an interpretation I would like to take seriously. That's the only place where I actually need the large N. For the discussion, I don't need it. For the connection to blocks, I don't need it. It's only for my desire to take this seriously that I need large N.
But just understand, the tangential, the part you would like to take seriously that you can't do generically is not just that it satisfies the equation.
Exactly. But this is actually a local field
theory. Sometimes a local field theory that determines the algebraic structure and the higher endpoint function.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Thanks for the question, actually. Yeah. You explained better than I did, so good. So we're one step away for completing this connection, which should now be obvious. I have derived an OPE in terms of these fields. And I can ask what the four-point function is. In that case, you can take, for example, four operators. And I can contract them in that way. I assume that, for example, some of the circle, this is 1, 2, 3, 4. I can individually expand this using this OPE. And we will see that a four-point function like that basically becomes modulo these three factors over here. It becomes a sum over two-point functions in kinematic space of these kinematic fields, of these operators. It becomes a two-point function. But this, you will already recognize if you're familiar with CFT, this is precisely the definition of the conformal block. What we derive from that is that what I would call kinematic propagators are, in fact, conformal blocks. A comment that I will not elaborate on, but it's cute, is the fact that via this connection, you can actually understand why our space-time needed to be Lorentzian. Conformal blocks come with an analytic structure, and this analytic structure is consistent, if I interpret it as propagators, some geometry, only with a Lorentzian structure here. That's because over here, let's say I have 4 points. We know that conformal block singularities appear, let's restrict on a time slice to not care about null separations, although it extends there too. It appears when I take two of these points close to each other. But this is where I encounter singularity in the conformal blocks. But remember, what was the kinematic causality? When two geodesics share an endpoint, they're null separate. Furthermore, in the appearance of the singularity in the conformal block, the location of the other endpoint doesn't matter. So the singularity is extended. Therefore, my manifold, if I were to interpret conformal blocks as propagators in that manifold, cannot be Riemannian, since there I would only have point singularities. So we see this connection that the Lorentzian structure is actually related to reproducing the analytic structure of conformal blocks.
Excuse me, that's the Lorentzian structure of your kinematic space.
That's right, yes.
Which in fact is not, I mean, it's signature 2-2.
That's right, yeah.
So it's not really Lorentzian.
Yeah, so I restricted myself to a time slice to make that argument, in which case I have one auxiliary time. Yeah, if I consider an arbitrary space-like four-point function, I have null singularities, and then I do need two time-like directions to account for all of them. If I restrict myself to a specific 2D slice of my kinematic space, which corresponds to a time slice, then it becomes simpler. But I didn't want to complicate it too much because I'm not gonna spend too much time on that. But it's a nice feature of it, just because I claim that the Lorentzian structure is, as a matter of fact, necessary.
So you said the null separated if one interval is inside the other interval. But here you can have.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, that is because I didn't mention the Z2 symmetry that Aaron mentioned before. There's the structure of this space, if seen globally, is more complicated. It has a Z2 symmetry. That basically comes from a statement that, let's restrict it in a time slice, this can be thought of as living here or there. So in your choice of Lorentzian propagator, you have to make sure that you choose the Z2 symmetric Lorentzian propagator. This means that the propagator that treats the point and its antipodal on equal basis. If you do this, then indeed you get exactly this fixes that issue. It gets messy, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it's true. Good observation.
So as a historical comment, maybe it's worth to add that this is what we would call the propagator on the elliptic de Sitter space.
Yeah. Elliptic de Sitter is the space, the name of that space. Yes?
Are you restricted to contract in either that channel or the one that's like 1-4, 2-3, or can you expand in the 1-3?
So in this case, I'm restricted to expand in the 1-2-3-4. In the 1-2-3-4.
Right, or the 1-4-2-3, presumably.
Or the 1-4-2-3, precisely. I can't, yeah. Well, yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you get the other channel by simple continuation, or?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it. I don't know an obvious answer to it. I don't see a reason why I would, because right now it looks to me as two independent kinematic fields, but I haven't thought about it in detail, but yeah.
So the comment about elliptic de Sitter space was because kinematic space is a Z2 quotient of the thing because of the beginning of GDs, it can be characterized by either or two causal and
precise
diamonds.
I think I've lost track of what the goal is.
Sure.
So by using the kinematic framework, I've learned something about the CFT that wasn't obvious?
Yes. Well, yes, you learned something about the... Good. Let's see what we've said so far. We have constructed these objects and we made a connection between... We found the consistent way of building objects that can be independently treated and they have already absorbed the redundant kinematics in the OPE. That's a useful thing for applications in the CFT if one can understand this geometric framework. If one can understand these fields as actually propagating in a kinematic geometry, this could be a useful geometric language for describing the CFT. And what I was trying to emphasize is that various nice structures that people often care about are geometrically realized in my kinematic space. So if that geometric framework can actually be made more rigorous and can be extended, it would be a nice geometric language for describing CFT alone. Furthermore, we saw the connection between the modular Hamiltonian, this integral representation of the conformal block, and the OPE, which, to be fair, there was an integral representation of OPE, of conformal blocks in terms of shadow operators, but these calculations were done in Euclidean space, and it had some problems. One needed to do complicated procedures for actually picking out the right thing. And by following this approach, we found a nice integral representation of the OPE in Lorentzian signature that makes connection to to other structures, like the modular Hamiltonian. And now you're going to learn about holography. Was it clear? mildly satisfying.
But, I mean, this is fair to say you're producing different representations of equations that we already know.
Right? Yeah, it's CFT. I mean, you know CFT and you can derive these equations. What I'm saying is that by expressing things in this language, you can actually get my result. And let me connect to holography now. Yes?
I don't remember. Are you in CFT too? Just because of
yes, CFT too.
Right. So, well, this could go either way. Do you get anything by including Virasoro symmetry?
Excellent, yeah. So right now I'm doing the global group.
Right.
The Virasoro...
so everything you say applies also to higher dimensional CFT? Or?
Yeah, in principle these structures can be generalized.
Higher dimensional CFT is... How do you relate to kinematic space?
Sound we cannot talk about.
Okay.
So the inclusion of the... Let me actually make that comment after I make the holographic connection. Yes.
So these are global blocks.
These are global blocks. Global blocks. Yes. Yes.
For all the derivatives, so that looks like you've got all the derivatives. Sort of,
no stress.
No stress tensors there. So let's make a connection to holography. This part of the framework is going to be more detailed presented in more detail by Sam after me. But can I have 10 more minutes? We want to make a connection to holography ultimately. As I was just presenting you the CFT framework now, the connection to holography is basically the following. The only function I have defined on my kinematic space from the bulk perspective is the length of a geodesic. This can be expressed as an integral over this geodesic of the proper length. Well, this is a trivial case of a more general integral transform called the Rey transform or Radon transform, depending on what you want to do. If I have, for example, a function, or in our case, an operator valued function on a bulk, then I can define its Radon transform to be basically the integral of this. Of the function psi along the geodesic. This will be this will define a function in kinematic space from the bulk. Well, one can actually confirm that expectation. This is in fact using the basic principles of the holographic dictionary at leading order in N, of course. One can show that if we use a psi, the local operator corresponding to a free field in the bulk, and we perform this integration using the extrapolate dictionary, one can show that this field is in fact the one I showed before, the one I built before. This is smeared over the Kolob diamond operator. And now we see that it naturally comes out of this framework the other piece of the story that I promised you, the story about geodesic weighted diagrams. Since it's now probably obvious, if you believe that I did this calculation correctly, and Sam is going to prove to you that this calculation is in fact correct, then we know that the conformal block is a two-point function of my kinematic operators. The only thing I have to do is to actually put this integral inside my correlation function and have this holographic dual. So what I'll get out of this is two integrals along the two geodesics defined by the four insertions of the two-point function in ADS. Again, leading order in N statement.
Excuse me. Is it really just a simple integral of the bulk field over the geodesic with no weighting and no dependence on the mass? Or
I'm integrating with respect to a weight against the proper length. But this is the only thing.
Yeah, the proper
length. Yeah, but that's the only thing. Yeah, no weighting.
No.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, you will see it robustly. This is a specific type of transforms. and they have certain nice properties. For example, if this satisfies the free equation in ADS, you can commute with the integral, and this becomes the free equation on the space of geodesics, as Sam will prove.
After saying that, did you use the fact that delta equals delta and delta prime equals delta prime?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I did use delta equals delta and delta prime equals delta prime.
So the statement is that if we weren't using the LP on operators of equal weight, then presumably there is some weighting along the geodesic. But for the case of using the LP with equal weight operators, the weight is trivial along the geodesic.
So if I remember more complicated formulas from talks by Tarek Krauss, those simplify in the equal weight case? Is that?
Yes, they simplify in equal weight case. And this is precisely what this looks like is basically take two geodesics defined by the two insertions, and you propagate from one geodesic to the other, and you integrate this propagator over this geodesic and that geodesic. This is precisely what the story about geodesic weighted diagram was, or at least in a particular case. We're working on the extension as well for tensor fields and understanding in this framework. But this is precisely what it was. Well, actually, you know, just because not all of you may be familiar with the story, the point was that we know how to compute four-point functions holographically. Let's say we have a cubic interaction. We propagate. I should probably be drawing. We're propagating propagators in the bulk. And we have vertices, which we're instructed to integrate over the entire ADS space. What Per Krauss, Ihano, Perlmutter, and Snively told us is that if you actually want to pick up a specific contribution, a specific conformal block contribution to this four-point function, instead of integrating these vertices over the entire ADS, you're supposed to integrate it over the corresponding geodesics. Well, we can use this geodesic propagator thing that I just derived for you in order to actually show their statement exactly. This is precisely the basic building block for that.
Just to understand the restriction, remind me, is if I think about a four-point function where it's O delta, O delta prime, O delta, O delta prime, so same thing in a different order, is that a different conformal block, or is that the same conformal block?
Well, it depends on the channel you're contracting. But if you're considering it in a different order, then you're going to have different contributions.
The conformal block depends not only on the correlator, but also on the choice that you're
Yes.
Okay, fine. These are light operators, I guess, yeah. So an important part of their story was at least they got light, heavy.
Light, heavy. Yeah, they included back reaction, and that goes to the Virasoro story. That they included back reaction by basically, and that helped them account for this heavy light limit. And we're working on that too. It's a matter of including Virasoro channels in this framework. In our geometric framework, this would ideally look like interactions in our geometry, which I can't say much about it. Yet. And some comments about 1 over n, which is going to be the last part of my talk. And
the reason for that is because in the light limit, the Virasoro blocks reduce to the global blocks.
That's right, yeah. Everything I've been doing here is leading order in n. So one would like to ultimately account for the 1 over n corrections, at least in the holographic context, since, as for example, Sam will show you, you can actually use these operators, these Radon transforms, to actually get an alternative route to the HKLL and reconstruct operators starting from our building blocks. So one would, from this perspective, one would actually like to have a systematic understanding of how we go about beyond 1 over n. And if one adapts a perturbative approach of HKLL type, it looks like, and this is work in progress, so I won't make any big statements, it looks like you can actually follow two routes. You can actually correct these operators that I defined at 1 over n to account for bulk locality and preserve the interpretation as geodesic operators. Operators integrated along a geodesic. Or one can go the other way, and one can correct these things at 1 over n in order to account for the higher point correlators as coming from local interactions in this auxiliary geometry of kinematic space that I briefly discussed. That's basically why I was insisting on commenting on 1 over n, because I would actually like, although I don't know if it's possible and what conditions and what restrictions we'll find in the way, I would actually like to see if it's actually possible to lift this structure in an actual geometric language for describing CFTs as well, even at, in a perturbative fashion about 1 over n.
Can I get you to repeat that in a different language? I didn't quite follow. I mean,
I'm sorry.
The story on the left, we agreed, is just CFT, and you didn't use any 1 over n expansion.
That's right.
Now, you can certainly write down your map, psi ADS of x to phi by integrating along the GDZ. Well, you can at least do that at all orders in 1 over n. It's not limited.
Yes.
What was the statement about the agreement between these two things?
If I actually take the fully interacting field here,
yes,
and I integrate it along a geodesic,
yes,
and I calculate its boundary, the operator dual to that on the boundary, this is not going to be the operator that I wrote you down as a kinematic operator. This is going to be the leading piece.
Okay.
I'm going to have 1 over n contributions to that. So one can systematically account for these 1 over n contributions to make this interpretation of this bulk interpretation consistent. One can do that in a systematic way.
You change the integrand, you still integrate along the GDZ.
No, you still integrate exactly the same thing in the bulk, but you're going to have to add extra stuff on my CFT definition of my kinematic fields in order to account for that.
Okay.
And one can derive this thing. But you can, what I'm saying is that you can actually go the other way as well and choose this and forget about the holographic interpretation and just say, I know that these operators that I define have, from the CFT perspective, they have non-trivial 3 or 4 point functions.
Yeah.
And I have an equation that describes them as freely propagating fields, so I shouldn't take that equation as seriously describing the propagation of local modes on this kinematic geometry I keep mentioning. But one can think of correcting the definition by a 1 over n contribution to actually account, for example, for the first subleading term in these correlation functions as coming from a locally interacting field in this kinematic geometry. Yes?
Can you invert that equation, phi equals integral psi?
Yes. Actually, I can't, but Sam can. So, Sam can. So, thanks for listening.
Let you go. I would like to ask one more question. I'd like to understand better to what extent the structure you define. Maybe it's a question for Sam. If so, tell me. But to what extent this is really a story about kinematic space as opposed to conformal group theory on bilocal operators. And so, this was a story as written about vacuum state. But if it was really a story about kinematic space, it would have a natural generalization. You know, take some state which is not the vacuum, and which is not even the vacuum locally, but you act on it with a smeared stress tensor or something, you have some kinematic space. Is it true that there's a similar OPE with nice conformal blocks defined by solving the wave equation in the kinematic space metric?
With the other geometry.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the dream. That's all I know about it. I don't know if it actually works.
It's a conjecture you like, but
it's a conjecture that I would like to explore. And I mean, we're not attached to the kinematic metric necessarily. We're trying to identify the right structures and the right language of actually describing these objects in the first place. We start from that. We would like to understand ultimately how to talk about excited states as well. One way to go about it, for example, is to account for to actually incorporate the story of interactions. That would be definitely a first step towards that. Now, if one can actually excite the state by some heavy operator and create some different kinematic space with different entanglement structure, and one can take feedback from that and build this framework, that would be great. I don't know if it's possible.
But you know it works for the particular state that Don suggested, which is acting with the stress tensor. Because that's, well, we were talking about that yesterday. In that case, there's a family of excited states, but I think it's all relying still on the underlying conformal symmetry.
Conformal symmetry.
Well, acting with the stress tensor, I'm introducing boundary gravity in states, right? So, that part is understood to some
extent.
For small perturbations about that state, right. For small perturbations, I can understand this.
This is also trivial, right? It's just conformal field theory.
Yeah, exactly.
In that regard.
All right, thanks. So let's take a 15-minute break, shall we? And come back for Sam. All right, thanks very much.